Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at FoleyTom. And the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. Today, we have a very exciting guest. His name is Steven Weinman, principal of FQHC Associates. Steve, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Awesome. So you bring a very unique perspective based on your background and experience in healthcare. You know, as we've done in the prep, a lot of what we'll talk about is the intersection of FQHCs, virtual care, and patient-centered medical home. And so that in and of itself is going to be a very interesting conversation because, you know, the shift, as we talk about, is occurring across the delivery of care. And sometimes the underserved are obviously not served well in this move towards adoption of technology and the enhancement of access points to the delivery of care. Before we get into the details here, tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us a little bit about FQHC Associates.
Sure. Well, many years back, I mean, I guess I'm showing my age here, but I have an IT background. What I call myself is an obsolete programmer, system designer. Back in the day when I started, we didn't have terminals, we had punch cards, and that's how we did things. So I guess I'm dating myself. I received an MBA the old-fashioned way, went to school full-time, and right out of school, I went to work for what's now PricewaterhouseCoopers as a management consultant in 1982. In 1984, I got involved for the first time with community health centers. And community health centers and federally qualified health centers, or FQHC, we're going to use those terms interchangeably. At the time I started, there was no such thing as FQHC. And FQHC is really just a legal status that community health centers have. So I just don't want to confuse anybody in the audience. So anyhow, in 1984, they hired me to fix some software that they purchased that didn't work. So I started doing that. I figured I'd be there 6 months, a year tops. I'd get the thing rocking and rolling, and then I would move on to my next job. But something happened when I was working at this health center, and I fell in love with their mission. I saw how they were helping people who didn't have any access to healthcare anywhere else. They were hard to reach. They were making huge differences in people's lives. People that didn't have any money and couldn't afford to pay would come by and bring us boxes of tomatoes and corn and peppers. And it just felt like a great thing to do. So I stuck with it. They somehow promoted me to be the chief financial officer. Became the chief operating officer, the chief executive officer. I had the opportunity to build a Medicaid managed care plan, which was interesting and a lot of fun. So I tell people I did every non-clinical job in the organization. And the joke was that if you didn't pay your bill, I would also do your dentistry and it would hurt a lot. So I did that for nearly 30 years. And I retired and began full-time consulting in 2013. I brought some of my staff with me, and we started working as FQHC Associates. So what we do at FQHC Associates is we work with health centers across the country to provide them any service they need related to the operation of their program, finance, technology, assistance with their grants, helping them with their clinical quality. And then another important part of what we do is we work with organizations that want to become federally qualified health centers and aren't sure if they qualify or aren't sure what they have to do. So we help them through the entire process, assuming that they're an appropriate organization to become an FQHC.
Interesting. So, some of the stats that you had provided prior to the show state that in 2020, health centers, over 1,400 organizations, 1,305 over 1,300 sites, 255,000 full-time staff served over 29 million people, including one in three living in poverty, one in five uninsured, one in five rural residents, nearly 3 million patients 65 and over. Those are very interesting stats. In some contexts, I look at that as a very positive thing, and there are some negative sides to that. And the negative side, and I'm not trying to be the negative guy here, but one in three living in poverty, it says that there's two in three that still need help, right? And there's one in five uninsured. That means there's four in five uninsured still not getting access to care. I'm not saying that the only access point is a community health center or an FQHC location, but it does speak to the challenge. And I will add, one in five rural residents, the question is, where does the four and five go? So there's a lot more that we need to do. And that's really part of the shift in how we increase access to care and make sure that all are served in one way, shape, or form. So tell us a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit more about an FQHC and the services that they provide in a community?
Sure. Well, federally qualified health center is an organization that meets a number of standards that's required by the funders, the federal government, which is HRSA, Health Resource and Services Administration, which is part of Health and Human Services, HHS. So they there's two ways to become a community health center. One of them is to become an FQHC, apply for a grant, and they give out in operating grants about little less than $5 billion a year to those 1,400 organizations across the country. Or you can become what's known as an FQHC lookalike, and that means it operates exactly the way an FQHC does, but it doesn't get a grant, but it does get some other benefits. So, because of their mission to take care of the poor and the underserved, they are given certain advantages over your run-of-the-mill provider. And the main one would be enhanced Medicaid and Medicare rates. That's in federal law. There's what's called a prospective payment system in every state and territory. And the health centers typically receive a much higher reimbursement than you would if you were just a private physician. But of course, there's no such thing as a free lunch. So, in return for this benefit, you have to agree to see people that can't afford to pay on a sliding scale. And it's pretty well defined by the government. If you're under 100% of poverty as your family income, you essentially can pay a small fee, but not too much. I mean, typically it's $25 or less. If you earn over 200% of the federal poverty level, you can't get any discount at all. So you essentially are charged the same way that you would in a private office. And then in between, it slides based on the categories. So HRSA has funded this program. Actually, it began as a demonstration project during the Johnson administration in 1965. And they ran a demonstration program for 10 years. It was very successful. In 1975, it was permanently funded and became law, and it has taken off and grown ever since. What's unique about this program is, well, if you look at federal programs in general and the objections that people have to them, what I tend to hear is, well, I don't want anybody in Washington telling me how to do things here and whatever, insert the name of the town that you're living in. We know best. The health center, to my knowledge, is the only federal program that acknowledges that. So every federally qualified health center is an individual, not-for-profit corporation, or in some cases, a governmental entity, and it's controlled locally. So there has to had board of directors at the health center that is made up of people that either live or work in the geographic area that's being served. And more importantly, more than half of the board members, which there has to be between 9 and 25 members on the board, more than half of them have to be patients of the health center and receive their services there. So really, it's the only system I've seen in healthcare where the patients are actually controlling their own destiny.
I did not know that, that the patients were on the board of the FQHC. That is such a very unique twist. And, you know, just talking about community health, having the patients themselves participate in the definition of the services that they receive is an awesome thing. So tell us more. I apologize for interrupting, but that was very important.
So because of this, there's a saying in the industry that if you've seen one FQHC, you've seen one FQHC. And to a great extent, that's true. There are many rules. I mean, it is, after all, a federal program. So what would a federal program be without rules? There is a set of required services that have to be provided in a manner that's acceptable to the funders, but the health center determines how much of each of the service is provided and in what manner. So some health centers choose, for example, to have a model where they have a couple of physicians and many more nurse practitioners or physician assistants. Other organizations tend to not like that model, and they go with more physicians and less nurse practitioners and physician assistants. They are all required to provide dental services, but some of them build a big dental program internally. Some of them contract out to another organization to provide dental. And as long as the service delivery meets the federal guidelines in terms of quality and also in terms of cost to the patient, because I mean, clearly we are a safety net program in that we're open to everybody, no matter how much money they have. We tend to take care of people that don't have much, but surprisingly, we take care of a lot of people that have plenty of money. And in my experience, when I was with the health center in Southwest Florida, we were the largest provider in the county, and other than the inpatient providers at the hospital. And we had many, many patients that I know were millionaires, multimillionaires, and they came to us not because they needed discounted services, but because the quality of our services were so good.
Interesting. So there seems to be, in my view, a disproportionate number of FQHCs that are also NCQA, patient-centered medical home certified. Is that a federal requirement that that model be adopted, or is that, to your point earlier about everyone decides how they want to adopt their delivery of care model?
It's not a requirement. They don't require you to be PCMH, just like they don't require you to be accredited through the Joint Commission or through the AAAHC. But let's say they strongly encourage it. And the reason for that, I think, is what I alluded to before. If health centers have one problem, it's an image problem. And the image problem is that we are the provider of choice for them who don't have a choice. And that's not really the case. And when people, you know, when I hear that from people, what I tell them is, I say, well, you know, next time you go to your dentist's office, just ask the dentist if you can have a look at his sterilization log for his autoclave, where he cleans his instruments. And I would bet you 10 to 1 that he's going to look at you like you just landed from Mars, and he doesn't have that. Well, health centers have those things because we're held to such high standards. We have teams that come out to the health centers and look at what we do to make sure that it's high quality. So with PCMH, when that started to become a thing, the funders encouraged us and gave us a little bit of funding to help us prepare for and become PCMH recognized, which about 3/4 of the health centers have PCMH recognition, either from NCQA or from another entity. There's other entities that do it now.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Virtual Shift. I'm your host, Tom Foley, and we're talking today with Stephen Weinman. He is the principal at FQHC Associates. And the topic of conversation today is the intersection of FQHC's patient-centered medical home and virtual care. Before we get, there's a very interesting conversation, and I've been in healthcare over 20 years, and you're educating me here, which I totally appreciate. Always a lifelong learner. So, FQHC's community health centers, tell us a little bit about how they're leveraging virtual care, and in what context? And because virtual care has a very broad meaning, from video encounters to audio encounters to full remote patient monitoring. Tell us a little bit about how they're adopting it and what they did during COVID to get through the pandemic.
Well, sure. Well, you know, when I was back at the beginning of this discussion, when I was telling you about my background, I mean, the first thing that you might notice is, okay, it was 1984 and they were already utilizing a computerized practice management system. This was a time when most practices, I mean, unless you were a hospital or a large multi-specialty group practice, they were using a handwritten system. I mean, computers were not that big. The IBM PC had not been out that long. And in fact, my first PC at that job had 2 floppy drives in it, and that was it. So, I mean, it was, and you think back, I ran a whole organization with probably 100 terminals on a machine that had, less than a megabyte of memory and less than 200 megabytes of hard drive storage. So, I mean, compare that to my cell phone, which is 1,000 times more powerful than that.
And, so, and for those that don't know, back then, a megabyte of storage was cost $1,000 more than what most PCs cost this day. So, but yeah. I digress.
It was a different world. But
it was a different world.
We became early adapters of technology. And the main reason for that, I mean, is it actually had to do with our government funding. One thing about the federal government, they do like to keep tabs on what you're doing, and we had reporting that we had to do. I know that's a shock to you. We had to report to them. At the time, it was every 6 months. Now, thankfully, it's less. And as the programs were growing, it became difficult to compile these reports without having the aid of a computer. So a lot of health centers started computerizing early. And once the technology was in the organization, as things changed, of course, there were no electronic health records available, except the VA had some and a few other people had some. As those became available, health centers, again, were early adopters of that technology. And the feds encouraged it by giving some funding to groups of health centers to buy into these EHR. So we were way ahead of the curve in terms of automating. So now you fast forward to telemedicine. I mean, I remember the first telemedicine grant we got, we had a cart with equipment on it that was huge, and it didn't want to connect up to the other equipment on the other side unless it was exactly identical. The standards were crazy. So, I mean, our first attempt at telemedicine was probably 20 years ago, and I'd call it a dismal failure. Probably half a dozen patients got telehealth because we just couldn't work it out. The other issue with telehealth, which has remained up until the COVID epidemic, is how do you get paid for telehealth? And I mean, I truly believe that the technology is not what's held back telehealth, but it's the reimbursement model from both CMS for Medicare, and of course the private companies, they pretty much piggyback on what Medicare is doing. So you fast forward to COVID-19, and all of a sudden, nobody's supposed to leave their house. Well, how are we supposed to get our health care? Well, we should be using telehealth because then you don't have to leave your house. What's missing? Can't get paid for it. Amazingly, once they reacted, I thought amazingly fast for government, because typically you'd expect government to fix the problem long after it wasn't a problem anymore. But I mean, they surprised us and they allowed for us to actually get paid for telehealth services. And voila, we could do telehealth. So health centers, because they were already playing with telehealth, were really ahead of the curve on this. Telehealth wasn't used that much, but starting in 2019, we actually had to report, when we reported back to the feds, we told them how many in-person visits we had and how many telehealth visits we had. So in comparing the 2009 report for the whole country to the 2019 report, rather, to the 2020 report, we had a 6,000% increase in telehealth at the community health centers. I mean, which is just a staggering amount. Of course, most private practices, you can't even compute their increase because they had zero before. And so that they had, you know, if they went from one to one visit, it would be an infinite increase. So in 2020, we had a total of about 114 million visits at the health centers. And out of that 114 million, over 28.5 million, or a quarter of them, were virtual.
Interesting. So what I'm learning here is, one, I was one of those folks that thought FQHCs were community health centers that were certified via FQHC was intended to address the ones with the most need. But what you taught us was that one, that's not true. Its services are open to everyone, but there is a unique position to help those that are underserved. But the quality of care, because of relative to the influence of being PCMH certified, it seems that there might be a correlation between a higher quality of care in that, with that model, than you would normally find. So and then obviously the extension of virtual care, and it's not just about the patient visit. In my view, the next extension is because of CMS, you know, reaching into that home. You know, why do I need to leave my home? Was your question? I would argue you don't. And remote patient monitoring is that extension to provide that continuous care, not that episodic care. So the point is that patient-centered medical home seems to be akin to a value-based care model, and the FQHCs and their strong relationship with a patient-centered medical home certification seems to be a model that we should look to replicate moving forward. So with that, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that.
So let me just ask you a question. If the federal government were to further attempt to enhance the adoption of technology, do you think that following that FQHC model coupled with patient-centered medical home could be a model that they ask the rest of the market to adopt? Is that viable? Is that reasonable? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think they've already moved in that direction. Because, I mean, go back a little bit, and it's a fairly recent phenomenon that quality figures into reimbursement. I mean, that was pretty much unheard of, I don't know, even 15 years ago. And now quality is all about the reimbursement. I got that backwards, actually. Reimbursement has a lot to do with quality. And the thing that was really interesting is when they started to have more transparency in terms of who was having the high quality outcomes. And you can go online and search a data warehouse of the community health centers. You can pick any community health center in the country and you can see what their quality metrics were. And that's something that's really good to know. If you're diabetic, I mean, diabetes is one of the largest problems that we have these days. If you're a diabetic, it's nice to know that the organization you're going to has good results in helping diabetes control their blood sugar.
I apologize, but we're going to have to stop it there. That's a very interesting point, and may call a need for part two of this conversation. But Steve Weinman, principal of FQHC Associates, you're doing some great work, very insightful, and I appreciate you coming on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hopefully we can do this again soon. I would like to thank the show sponsors, both HP and Intel. HP Engage long lifecycle products provide the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. As well, Intel would like you to know we're going above and beyond together with new standards for business with the latest Intel vPro processors, delivering what IT needs for performance, security, remote manageability, and stability. And be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.